You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
On April 28, 2018, theologian James Cone died, and many like me who were seminarians in the last quarter of the 20th century knew that a giant had passed from our midst. Back in October 2018, the Christian Humanist podcast dedicated a trio of episodes, numbers 247, 248, and 249, to his book God of the Oppressed. And now, on Christian Humanist Profiles, we're glad to welcome Dr. Adam Clark, Associate Professor of Theology at Xavier University, to continue our conversation about Dr. Cone's work and legacy. Adam, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you.
Adam, so that our listeners know you a little bit, I'll say that you and I met at Theology Beer Camp in Los Angeles a couple years ago, and I know from conversations with you that, among other things, you're a scholar of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, a teacher of spirituality within activist theology. What else do you want our listeners to know about you and your history with Dr. Cone and his work?
Well, he was my doctoral mentor at Union Theological Seminary, and I'm currently the co-chair of Black Theology at the American Academy of Religion. I'm starting a Black Theology Papers Project at Union Theological Seminary and Columbia University, and I'm also part of the editing team of a book that should be coming out in about maybe a year or two, and working on a book myself on Black theology.
Very good, very good. Well, when that comes out, you have to let me know. We'll have you back on the show.
Sure, great.
Well, as we continue, I'll remind our listeners that this conversation will build on what we discussed in the Christian Humanist podcast, again, episodes 247 to 249, and we invite you to listen to those before digging into this one, because we're going to assume that you've heard that material before you hear this. So, Adam, I'm going to start by asking you a question of historical situation. So Dr. Cone's work begins in medias res, as do all theologians' work. But when you teach Cone's work, what kinds of historical backgrounds do your students need in place before you can begin on his thought?
In terms of historical background, we do a lot of work with getting students to understand the 1960s and all of the specifically the Black Freedom Movement. So that the Black Freedom Movement consists of two things. First phase is the Civil Rights phase, which lasts from about 1956 to around maybe 1964, 65. And that's the Civil Rights. That's the dimension where Martin Luther King and all the civil rights workers are struggling against mostly legal obstacles to desegregation. And then the second phase of that movement is the Black Power phase, which is probably classically understood from about 1966 to 1972 or three, which is Malcolm X and mostly the people who actually followed Malcolm, such as the Black Panther Party, the US movement, and numerous other Black nationalist organizations that stress self-determination and Black identity. And that was the second phase of the movement. So in order to understand Black theology, you have to understand those two movements as they emerge out of the 60s and as they start to shape the consciousness of Black Christians in Christian churches.
And James Cone, I mean, in this book and in his book, Martin, Malcolm, and America, which I also strongly recommend, self-identifies as a specifically Christian theologian. Talk just a little bit, give us a broad framework of the relationships between those historical particularities of the latter half of the 20th century and that Christian tradition that he is a part of.
Well, what happens with Cone specifically and with the Black Power movement and Black radical clergy and more generally is really, it becomes through the idea of Malcolm X. Malcolm X, one of Malcolm's critique against Christianity is that Christianity was a white man's religion, and that as long as Black people struggle for freedom under a religion that's not their own, they would never be free. So what Malcolm did that's different from other Black freedom movement people is that he just didn't problematize the question of race in America. He problematized the question of religion. And really, before Malcolm, black people referred to themselves as Negroes, not as black. So it was clear what the Negro church should do in terms of struggle. It wasn't clear what the black church should do, because the black church actually started to question the efficacy of Christian faith in the struggle for freedom. So what black theology did in terms of response to that, it tried to rethink the relationship between blackness and Christian identity. So the first question of black theology is, what does it mean to be black and Christian, right? How do you unite the two? Do we have to, and the difference between black, Negro and blackness is not just a semantic change, it was a conceptual change. Negro referred to a kind of deferential posture to white supremacy and to white people. Blackness was a way of trying to talk about self-determination and self-affirmation. So the idea of having this new type of powerful, radical black identity and to try to mix it with Christian faith was very novel and very new. And the Black Theology Project came out of trying to weave together these two distinct traditions.
Very good. Well, Adam, whenever I teach any significant thinker, whether we're talking an American thinker or a Japanese thinker or a Greek thinker, one of my central aims for my students is to highlight the questions that a thinker, whether Shusaku Endo or Aristotle or James Cone, poses that we wouldn't be posing ourselves except that we had read the thinker at hand. So what are some of the questions that James Cone poses, and what kinds of research and other work have grown out of those questions?
Well, the most primary question, as I said, was the idea of being, what does it mean to be black and Christian? And blackness was defined by the movement of Malcolm X and the Black Power people. That is the switch from Negro to black. And this was a way of trying to capture what it meant to be human as emerging out of the black experience. We can't talk about our humanity without talking about our blackness. The second question is, what does it mean to be Christian? And the idea of Christianity was shaped by Martin Luther King Jr. that made Christianity into a social justice project. So Christianity wasn't just about abstract ideas about going to heaven. King differed very vigorously from people like Billy Graham at the time, who had the kind of the dominant understanding of what Christian faith was. Billy Graham actually disagreed with King at the time, but they were contemporaries of each other. But when Billy Graham is going around doing crusades in the South, he wasn't joining the civil rights people and trying to break down the barriers of segregation. He was talking about the salvation of souls. What King did, King said, look, it's not just your soul, it's the condition in which the soul rests. It's the person, it's the body, right? We have to talk about the redeeming of whole people, not the redemption of one soul exclusively. So King made it a social justice. So what does it mean to be black? What does it mean to be Christian? And later on, there's a kind of a third question that's implicit in that, is what does it mean to be free? And freedom was defined by a lot of the third world liberation movements in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. So all of those type of anti-colonial movements help shape the question of what it meant to be free. So what does it mean to be black? What does it mean to be Christian? And what does it mean to be free became the kind of primary thrust of black theology. And related to that, in terms of a more traditional theological framing of this, had to do with, how do you tell people that God is love in light of the condition of black people, right? Or poor people? This was the question of liberationists, is that if you're going to say God is love, but yet the people in which you come out of have been poor and have faced obstacles for centuries, how do you make that a credible claim? So the idea of trying to say God is love and make that credible also was a radical impulse for the Black Theology Project.
All right. I want to follow up on the notion of freedom, that idea that you presented there. You know, when I think of the history of that term, you know, I certainly think of places like, you know, the Roman notion of libertas. I think of Machiavelli and the notion of freedom as the highest goal for a city. I think, of course, of, you know, American founding documents and their strong concern with liberty. What does a post-colonial perspective add to those notions of liberty, freedom?
Well, you know, freedom is used in such a plurality of ways within Black theological discourse. Primarily, it was used, I mean, it was used existentially. It was kind of oppositional to what the obstacles in your way. So when you first started seeing the idea of freedom, it was literally just freedom from racial oppression and racial incarceration. So it had to do with freedom of body, kind of mental freedom, being able to think and imagine in new ways. It had to do with just literally bodily freedom, like to kind of be able to move where you need to go. It had to do with spiritual freedom. So a lot of it was defined in a kind of negatives as kind of the elimination of restraints that were specifically due to race, right? Now, a correlate of that. That wasn't as developed in Cone's work, but other Black theologians started to think about freedom in terms of a positive affirmation of freedom, in terms of justice. Like, what are we affirming when we say we're free? We're free to what? Well, we're free to be just or in right relationships. And part of the theological project also is trying to imagine what right relationships looks like. Like, what are we? We're not just free to do anything we want if we're people of faith. We have to affirm something. So we're affirming a certain type of relationship with other people, with the environment, and with ourselves. So that's basically in terms of the way Black freedom is used within Black theological and liberationist discourse as well.
Okay. Well, Adam, I saw you posting photos of a recent theology class you taught. So, I mean, I want to turn and ask you a teacher question for a moment. In your work with theology students, I mean, what are the points and the maneuvers and the concerns within Cone's work that students tend to misunderstand without your help?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say probably the most misunderstood aspect of Cone's work is the militant affirmation of Blackness, right? Because most students are just not familiar with radical affirmations of Blackness.
And
So,
can you tell our listeners what that term means?
well, when I say a radical affirmation of, I mean, even when Cone like wrote the book, his first book, Black Theology, Black Power, or Black Theology of Liberation, he got a lot of pressure from other people, he said, to say, well, why do you say black? What's the qualifier black in front of liberation theology? Why don't you just call it liberation theology? Why the black, right? So the concern become from other people becomes, are you being imprisoned in your own particularity, right? Are you just really trying to talk to only a slice of black people and you're not trying to be universalist, right? There's always a
Right,
guy.
right. Do you have anything to say beyond this very defined community?
Exactly. So, in trying to help people understand, Cone is really trying to speak to the world and not to black people, is that blackness is unsymbolically for the oppressed, or it's a categorical understanding. It means a variety of things within black theological discourse, but more specifically, it's kind of a symbolic for the existential commitment to the oppressed. So in Cone's discourse, white people can be black, right? In terms of their identification with the downtrodden, with the dispossessed, with the disenfranchised. It's a way of how your solidarity flows. It's not always just specific to black people or pigmentation. It has to do with the condition of one's heart and soul more than the condition of or the your specific phenotype.
Yeah, so I mean, you say it's a more of a political term than a biological term, then?
Yeah, that's one way of understanding it. That Cone is talking blackness in a political way than really talking about any type of physiological features. Even when he talks about the Black Christ, when he talks about, he doesn't talk about Black Jesus in terms of the historical Jesus. He talks about Christ in terms of the way God is identifying in this world with the downtrodden and with the poor.
Okay. Do a little bit more with that distinction, because I think our listeners could benefit from that. I mean, why is it important to say that Jesus is not what we affiliate with blackness, but Christ is?
Yeah, and this is Cone. There's different – black theology as a whole is a heterodox discipline, meaning it has multiple different thinkers and debates within internal to it. Cone is just the most important thinker. But professional theologians usually make a distinction between the historical Jesus, that is the earthly Jesus, and the Christ of faith, meaning the risen Christ, the post-Easter Jesus, the contemporary Christ. So Cone many times talks about Black Christ, meaning who is Christ for us today? And he doesn't really talk about Black Jesus, and as in Jesus was Black 2,000 years ago, right? So he's not really making a claim, although he does claim he's not white, right? He's not.
Well, yeah, that historically is pretty easy to establish.
Right. Although, you know, sometimes if you look at certain Bibles and certain types of depictions, you might not think it's that easy.
I prefer not to look at those, Adam.
Right. Okay. Okay. So his theological claim is about Black Christ, and he really tries to say this is specific to North American American Christianity, because if you were in, let's say, India, you might talk about the Dalí Christ, right? Mm-hmm. The untouchable. That's the bottom. He says Christ identifies with the bottom. We're having we're actually having this conversation about 2 weeks before Christmas, right?
Yes.
So it reminds us that, you know, Christ was born to parents who didn't have a home, who was born in a manger with funk and stench and all that. That's the bottom. So blackness signifies the bottom in the context of American society, right? If you depict something as black, you're depicted as something that's close to the bottom. So solidarity with blackness and identifying with blackness signifies that for the work of James Cone.
Very good. One thing that we noticed when we talked through this book, Adam, is that it is a polemical book. It's calling theological opponents heretics at some points. It's questioning explicitly whether certain kinds of theologies are Christian at all, on pretty important points. Yeah. So as you see things, what place does polemical style have in 1975 theology, and to what extent does polemic still have a place in 2018 theology?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's usually an under-discussed point. What Cone is interested here at that time, and I would say even up to his recent passing, mm-hmm. is what is the public identity of Christian faith, right? A way of trying to frame that now is what does it mean that people who publicly identify with Christianity support Trump, right? Like, so uncritically, like, how is that when you have like all these institutions and people who claim to be who claim a certain type of authority in terms of their training and leadership positions within the Christian church, yes, they support politicians and things that are not identified with the radical Christ. And that's what Cone is using polemics against. He's trying to say, look, this is so incredulous, right? Like, these are radical times, which calls for a radicalized type language. And he's trying to call people to the urgency of understanding who Christ is in our times. And Christ is not a liberal or a conservative. Christ is a radical, and this is why. And
all that's right. How theology. Yeah, you say this is an urgent question. What gives it its urgency in our moment?
Well, much of the urgency has to do with like what's happening when you have families being split up, right? Urgency mm-hmm. at the borders, right? A lot of the urgency has to do with girls being dehydrated and dying in American hands. And then you have Christians who are silent on these issues. Urgency has to do with Charlottesville, Virginia. Urgency has to do with the lack of health care, right? People are – urgency has to do with reneging on environmental treaties and that type of thing. The urgency has to do with that our planet and our humanity is in peril, and Christians are silent and debating the margins of these points. Part of it has to do with how do we identify our faith as Christian and not scream at what's happening here, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So Cohen wants to have it that it's incompatible. One of another question that Cohen raises, can you be Christian and racist at the same time? Now, most people would just say automatically no, intrinsically, but most of Christian history in the United States has been either supportive of 246 years of slavery and another 100 years of racial apartheid in the United States, right? It wasn't until 1964 that we had the last legal bounds of racial oppression, legalized racial oppression struck down. And then after that, you have mass incarceration, which are a whole new series of laws that are able to do that. So that Cohen wanted to define the faith in a way that it was incompatible with doing those type of things, right? So his idea was you can't do wrong and think right, right? If you do wrong, then some of your claims about being authoritative about thinking about Christian faith should be disqualified, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking right, doing right, and thinking right are hand in hand. You can't do one without the other.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn to the Bible. One feature of God of the Oppressed that spurred conversation among the three of us is Cone's approach to the Bible. For Cone, Exodus seems to take pride of place in the canon, meaning that he reads the history of Israel and the ministry of Jesus and the role of the faithful in the present age in terms of liberation, like we've been talking about. As you understand Cone's broader corpus, because obviously you've not only studied him, but you've studied with him, what place do creation theology and redemption from sins and divine sovereignty and other kinds of points of focus for Christian theology, what place do those things have alongside liberation? Or are they always beneath liberation?
Well, here's how I think Cone to answer this question, mm-hmm. is that much of Christian theology was about faith versus the non-believer, so that the project of faith was about trying to convert non-believers into believers. Mm-hmm. What Cone reset the idea was that faith shouldn't be set against the non-believer. It should be set against the non-person. So anything that dehumanizes people's personhood should be the thing that faith is set against. So therefore, that's why liberation became such a strong theme, so you could liberate people from dehumanizing circumstances, ideas, and practices. Issues of creation, personal sin, and that type of thing were very secondary in terms of the way tragedy is kind of incarnated in Black life worlds, right? So that therefore there's not a whole lot about that type of thing, because for him, the major thing in terms of what it meant to be Christian was to struggle against evil and to struggle against things that dehumanize other people's humanity. So he was a person who really saw that Christianity was about a deep affirmation of the humanity of the other. And that's how he understood his particular faith perspective.
Mm-hmm. Now, to what extent, I mean, do you see that as particular to the late 20th century, early 21st century moment? And to what extent, either for Cone's theology or for your own Adam, you're not a possessive, to what extent do you see those as something that, you know, we can look with disapproval on previous eras for not doing that?
Wait, could you repeat that? Let me see.
Yeah, because I just mangled the grammar there. As we read Cone, I mean, one of the things we noted is that Cone has words not only for 20th century figures, but even for people as ancient as Augustine, for not focusing on liberation, right? As you read things, and again, you can answer for Cone and you can answer for yourself, and if they're the same, that's great. But to what extent, you know, is Cone a polemicist for our moment, and to what extent does he have a program that wants to reevaluate, you know, a much longer history of Christian theology?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that Cohn thinks that identification with the poor and dispossessed is what the historical Jesus does and is at the center of his mission. Mm-hmm. And to the degree that people in the tradition did not, or classical theological interpreters did not catch that, is to the degree they get critique from Cohn, right? Mm-hmm. So he would critique Augustine, Luther, Calvin for missing the idea that Christ is in solidarity with the poor. Mm-hmm. And that what he thought was that people were too, these theologians were too enamored with the magisterium or kind of ecclesial lifestyles or empire, right? They're too seduced by these ideas that they missed the poor, right? So that he saw that the movement of Christ was not contained by the church, but contained by the struggles of the poor trying to affirm their own humanity. That's where he saw the movement of God. He didn't really identify it with any type of denominational identity or with any type of kind of ecclesial continuity. It had to do with Christ in solidarity with those who are on the margins of each society, and that most of the times theologians miss this. And he says that's what was good news to the poor, right? That these interpreters are missing you, but God loves you.
All right, all right. One concern that we had, and I want to hear your response to this, is that in the last three chapters of the book, mainly, is where we saw this, Dr. Cohn seemed, when he was responding to his critics, and you and I talked actually before the Christian Humanist podcast recorded about how this book is largely a response to the White Academy and their response to A Black Theology of Liberation. Do I remember that right?
Yeah, you talk about God and the Oppressed, that particular
book. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that was fourth book, yes.
Yeah, so one thing that we saw in the closing chapters of the book when he's responding to those critics is that he seems to forswear common reasoning with them. They say that, you know, they want reasons that are, you know, valid within academic context, and he says, you know, not in exactly these words, and I don't have the page open in front of me, but, you know, you don't use the reasoning of the oppressor in order to oppose the oppressor. You invent new kinds of reasoning. Our worry about that move, Adam, is that, you know, with hindsight, 43 years of hindsight specifically, the move seemed to foreshadow some of the moves that we now call post-truth, the strong distrust of so-called elite education and elite reasoning and elite expertise. I know the two moves are not identical, and I want to give you an opportunity now to tell our listeners how and why they are not identical.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question. Yeah, Cohn wasn't talking about post-truth. He was talking about situated truth, okay. Right? Like it's about how truth is situated, and that what happens from the academy or from institutions of power is that they think they have a monopoly on the truth. And Cohn was very clear that everybody sees, as the Apostle Paul says, through a glass partially, right? Like we see refracted things. And what's happened is that the powerful have always said they've seen the whole and have kind of negated the reason of the marginalized. So the way Cohn was using that in that particular historical circumstances is just, and Malcolm X said something similar. Malcolm X said, we should not look at the reasoning of the oppressor, we should look at the reasoning of the oppressed. Mm-hmm. You can't beat, or what Audre Lorde talked about, he raised the question, can you dismantle the master's house with the master's tools?
Right. That's an aphorism that comes up a lot in God of the Oppressed.
Right. And that's Audre Lorde. But this is something that's kind of been within Black thought, and you see that amplified in Cohn's work. And what he's simply doing is just saying that, look, if we're going to really be serious about our freedom, we can't use the tools that our oppressor gives us, because we'll never be able to think and believe in our freedom if we are dependent on their intellectual apparatuses. we have to think for ourselves and validate. Remember, one of the things that Cone donated to Christian theology is that before Cone, no one thought that the Black experience was even a credible enough resource to think about God through or intellectual. Even with King, when King was in grad school in the 1950s, he never wanted to talk about race within graduate school because it wasn't seen as a topic that was scholarly acceptable. So when Cone starts this in like the late 1960s, to even look at people like Nat Turner, Denmark Veazey, Gabriel Prosser, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, to even look at them as God spoke to them is equally as authoritative as God speaking to Augustine and Aquinas, right? Was really, really crazy, right? Like, how are you going to look at this kind of a marginalized group and talk about that God moved or gave a message to the world through these figures as they are to these kind of classical, enshrined, canonical Christian figures? So what Cone is trying to say is that we don't have to go to the figures they go to talk about how God speaks to us or what God is doing. Why don't we go to these marginalized? They have something to teach us about God in ways that are equal and maybe even more authoritative as people who lived 1,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear the other side of this, though, because, you know, what I'm hearing you say, I think that it's valid. I can also hear people, you know, from the Fox News watching set saying, you know, for our experience, we don't need the New York elites. We don't need the fake news journalists. We don't need these sorts of people. People need to listen to us on our terms. And again, you know, when that move gets made, right, I think people rightly call that post-truth in a way that they wouldn't necessarily call what Dr. Cone was doing post-truth. What's the difference there?
Well, the difference would be that Cone would say the litmus test, and he's thinking as a Christian theologian also, so he's not really trying to think about this in terms of just a liberal arts framing of this or kind of secular or public framing of it.
Sure. He's,
for Christians, the test is Jesus Christ's solidarity with the dispossessed, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be the acid test to say that does it serve, is it faithful to Jesus's ministry, death and resurrection in solidarity with the dispossessed and the poor, or is it not? That would be the acid test to understand what truth means in terms of a Christian framework of it. And if it does totally ignores it, then it's something that can't be affirmed by faith. And that's where he uses these ideas of the polemics about heretical and those things are non-Christian and that type of thing. But if it's in solidarity with that, then yes, it is something that is a faith-based response and has integrity within it.
Okay. Well, Adam, like I said, I had read Malcolm Martin in America, or Martin Malcolm in America, I forget what order they come in, before I had read God of the Oppressed. But I've really not read a whole lot in James Cone's corpus. So as we start heading towards a wrap-up here, I mean, for our listeners who want to start reading James Cone, where should those listeners start?
I would say start with The Cross and the Lynching Tree.
Okay, that his most recent book.
Well, was that his most recent book? He just had something that came out posthumously where he talks more.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, it's a memoir that it's more of a memoir that kind of talks about his life, but In terms of a good place to start, in terms of his most recent, what he claimed is his favorite book, I would say start with The Cross and the Lynching Tree. That might be the safest way to go. The Cross and the Lynching Tree is a book, you know, I understand it to be like a meditation on death.
Okay.
But the last book is says I wasn't going to tell nobody. And that's more of kind of a theological journal where he talks about it. It's kind of autobiographical. He has another book he wrote in 1982 called My Soul Looks Back, which is similar to that. What I teach in my class, as far as the easy, accessible way of understanding Cone's thought is for my people, black theology in the black church. Let's see, what else would I recommend? There's a collection of essays in Speaking the Truth, Ecumenism, Liberation of Black Theology. But probably his most radical two works, at least the works I got introduced to the most that made me say, wow, what is this, would be his first book, Black Theology and Black Power and a Black Theology of Liberation. Mm-hmm. That's really not even written for academics. That's written for the Black liberation movement, and it's a lot of fire in those texts.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, Adam, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word today. What do you want our listeners thinking about James Cone, liberation theology, or anything else as we head for the door?
Wow. Well, you know, I think that we're in a moment where we really have to, where the situation of faith is in a new, is in a situation where we need to engage in a battle, I should say, to understand what is the public meaning of what it means to be Christian. And I think Cone is a path-breaking thinker in trying to get at that. And he really defines faith in a way that's incompatible with oppression. And I think that's why he's so respected and so revered. And he wanted people to struggle with their how their humanity is being affirmed and disqualified by faith, and that the themes of love, justice, and hope are at the center of any authentic way of being Christian.
Adam Clark, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.